The House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:55 p.m., Tuesday, November 17th, in the Anchorage LIO. Present are Representative Grunberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Clayman, and myself, Chair Ledoux. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take time to silence your cell phones at this point for the duration of the meeting. Before we proceed, there are two things that I would like to do. First of all, I would like a moment of silence for the victims of the Parisian terrorist attack. Thank you. Secondly, I would like to announce a new rule for the House Judiciary Committee. Whenever a member is more than 5 minutes late, along with cell phone problems, the member who is 5 minutes late or more will be required to bring donuts or some healthy food of their choice.
Madam Chair, this will make this the best Fed committee in the legislature.
Well, so be it.
I will say I'm going to change my way of living, and if that ain't enough.
All right, thank you. Today we are hearing version G of the Draft Committee Substitute for House Bill 126, Code of Military Justice Appeal. Can I get a motion to take up draft version G of the Committee Substitute for House Bill 126 as the working document?
So move.
Thank you. The House Judiciary adopts version G of the CS for HB 126 as the working document. And I wanted to let you know before we go any further that Representative Tuck is calling in, will be calling in, and I believe that Representative Guttenberg is on the phone right now, and as is Megan Wallace from Legal Services, who's going to be available for questions.
Yeah, move.
Sure. So to begin with, Captain Forrest Dunbar will be presenting this new draft of the committee substitute. Before he begins, let me briefly explain the documents members have before them. The working document before us is version G, which includes changes discussed at the last hearing on version I of the bill. Behind that, members have a copy of the legal memo for version G, a copy of Captain Dunbar's presentation, and a matrix of crimes and punishments of this bill. Captain Dunbar, please come forward and put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Captain Forrest Dunbar, spelled F-O-R-R-E-S-T-D-U-N-B-A-R. I'm with the Alaska National Guard.
Okay, you can proceed.
All right. Well, thank you for having this hearing and coming and discussing this bill again. As we'll be discussing, there have been a number of changes since we last met September 22nd. I feel that we've done a lot of really good work on this bill in this committee over the course of the last 6-7 months. And the bill is getting to a point where I know the National Guard, at least, is pretty happy with it. So in October, after the last time we met, I briefed this bill to the governor with the tag, the Adjutant General present, and the governor was supportive and seemed pleased with the work we had done. This continues to be a very high priority for the Adjutant General, and she's keeping me on full-time through at least the end of the year to continue working on this project. I hope to be down in Juneau occasionally, probably testifying this bill as well, although I don't know if I'll be there full time. But the point is that the National Guard remains very committed to this bill. We've also formed a red team, which I've spoken with several of you about. The red team was formed shortly after the last hearing. It is composed of soldiers and airmen, officers and enlisted. Importantly, they're all different from the people that we had on the Commander's Action Group that helped put this together over the summer, with the exception of myself and Major Elmore, who I think you're all familiar with, the executive officer of the Adjutant General. We run the meetings, but we have a new, fresh set of eyes looking at this bill, looking at the non-judicial punishment regulation, and trying to war game, basically, trying to go through scenarios and figure out how this would work in practice. And you can see up on the screen there in your packet four of the five scenarios that we've been working through. These are some of the more common offenses. Obviously, sexual assault isn't common exactly, but it's an issue that we care very much about. But things like substance abuse, inappropriate relationships, and absence without leave are some of our more common offenses. So we've been trying to war game those kind of scenarios. Also, in this latest version, version G, which we received last week, and I don't know about you, but every time I get a new version, it's like Christmas. I go through for the day, and I'm very excited to see what the new version says. This new version has a lot of the changes we discussed on September 22nd. So I know there were some concerns, which we'll talk about, that the representative, that the committee had, and it's my belief that Legislative Legal and Representative Ledoux's office and everyone else who was involved did a good job of addressing most, if not all, of those concerns. So the largest changes to this latest version, the most significant change is we have attached to every punitive article a maximum offense. And that's why you have the maximum punishments matrix, which I provided, which should be in your packet. And what that matrix shows is the maximum punishment that we will potentially mete out versus the maximum potential offense, maximum potential punishment in the federal UCMJ. And as you can see, if you look through there, in almost every case, the potential penalty under the federal UCMJ is significantly more severe. So, for example, we have certain offenses where 10 years is the maximum punishment that we will potentially give out. The federal UCMJ, the punishment is death. And we have made a policy choice that we're not going to pursue some of those more severe cases and some of those more severe penalties. We've also made a lot of the offenses essentially misdemeanors with a maximum of 1 year imprisonment. And this means that we don't have to do a grand jury. It also, I think, better reflects reality, which is the most severe misbehavior will happen either in a way that will lead to civilian charges, for example, in sex assault or rape or regular assault or arson or things like that, where the civilian authorities will step in, or in the cases where there's the death penalty, for example, on the federal side, that's usually in a time of war. And realistically, if we're in a time of war, in the vast majority of cases, you're going to be in Title 10 status, which we've discussed before. You'll be fully federalized. You'll be subject to the federal UCMJ.
So one of the things that I've noticed throughout this bill is that with many of the misdemeanor charges, the maximum penalty is still a dishonorable discharge.
Yes, ma'am.
And I guess I was just wondering about.
Yes, ma'am. Well, if you see, I think there's only one or two cases where the federal law calls for a bad conduct discharge and we still have a dishonorable discharge. In every other case, the federal law is all dishonorable discharge and we have kept it at that level. As we've discussed before, there are five levels of discharge, dishonorable being the most severe. But I think it's important, the way we wrote the bill, it doesn't say you have to give a dishonorable, it says you have up to a dishonorable that you can give. And that's something that, in most cases, we're not, for military offenses, you're not going to be seeking actual imprisonment. The real teeth of the charge is the ability to say it's a dishonorable discharge. And as we've discussed before, never in the history of this guard has a dishonorable discharge been given out. And so I think when it eventually happens, it'll be a big deal. But that is sort of the the portion of the maximum punishments that are more likely to be used is that discharge provision.
So under current law, do I understand correctly that in National Guard proceedings, somebody can be dishonorably discharged even now?
No, ma'am. So currently, it is impossible for the National Guard to give someone dishonorable discharge. In fact, it is impossible to give a bad conduct discharge. The most severe form of discharge we can give is what's called an other than honorable discharge. And that is because that is the most severe kind of discharge that's available under an administrative hearing. That's the most you can give in an administrative hearing, and so that's what we can do. So for the scandal and the people who were involved in the scandal, for the most part, they received other than honorable. That was the most severe we could give. And it's not a slap on the wrist. You are sent out of the military, and in most cases, you lose your retirement. You, in some cases, are busted down to E1. I mean, it is fairly severe, but it's not as severe as bad conduct or dishonorable.
Understand.
Let's see here. The second...
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Captain, the interplay between a proceeding under this new code of conduct and the civilian, do you see the two sovereigns working together? Because it could be very effectively done. Obviously, the defense has all kinds of discovery rights for the prosecution, not so much vice versa. However, if this proceeding could be begun and then terminated, there would be great discovery to go forward in the civilian sphere. Has that been contemplated?
So, Representative Greenberg, through the chair, there has been talk about how prosecutors on either side, the civilian and the Judge Advocate Corps, would share information. And certainly, we have established the Office of the Provost Marshal to coordinate between civilian law enforcement and the Guard, and I think these kind of things are talked about. But I will say, to your point, there is only one sovereign in this case. These are both, because it's all under state law. So even though we are military and the DA is civilian, it's only one sovereign. So as we've discussed before, and I'm sure you're aware, there is a double jeopardy issue. If jeopardy attaches on either side, either in a court-martial or in a civilian court, under these laws, the other side is precluded. Now, that's not the case if there's a federal charge, obviously. But because these are both state proceedings, you do have a double jeopardy concern. I'd say for charges that can be cognizable in civilian court, for charges that are civilian violations of civilian criminal law, we expect that the vast majority of the investigation will be done by civilians. They have more capability to do that than we do. We don't have our own sort of internal CID, if you will. And so in most cases, we would imagine the flow of information would go the other way. That is, the civilians would do the investigation, and then if they chose not to proceed, then we would proceed. And actually, that goes to our second point here, which is something that the chair, Representative Ledoux, stressed on September 22nd, which was there was some ambiguity about whether we could proceed if the civilians had not... we're also going to proceed. And so we clarified, that's another of the large changes, we clarified Section 400 so that it's very clear that we cannot go forward with a charge that is cognizable under civilian law unless the civilian prosecutors have affirmatively stated they are not going to go forward. So the civilians have the right of first refusal, always.
So I'm curious about something here. So what happens... Let's say you've got a sexual assault, which would have to go before a grand jury. And I believe that you would have to produce any exculpatory evidence in front of that grand jury. So the civilian court has refused to prosecute, presumably because there's some evidence in the files that's showing that they don't have much of a chance of winning. So how's that going to work in front of the grand jury?
So, ma'am, our standard of proof in courts martial is beyond a reasonable doubt, same as the civilian.
Same standard.
So if it was a sexual assault and the prosecutors on the civilian side felt that they didn't have the evidence to proceed, it's fairly unlikely that we would proceed. I said it's very unlikely we would proceed. So now we might be able to proceed on a different charge, right? There are other charges, conduct becoming an officer, violations of good order and discipline, that kind of thing, that we could potentially charge with. But we don't see ourselves going forward with prosecutions on sexual assault if the civilians have said we think that there isn't enough evidence here. The cases where we envision us going forward are cases where, primarily, where civilians have decided not to go forward for reasons of resource constraints, which maybe isn't a very realistic scenario given how aggressively our state pursues these days sexual assaults. And that certainly is our preference. We want the vast majority, if not all, sexual assaults to be prosecuted by civilian authorities for exactly these kind of reasons. We don't have the same capability that civilians do. We don't have the same expertise in prosecuting these as civilians do.
But this is just going to allow you to proceed where you've concluded independently that the civilian prosecutor is just wrong.
Not necessarily wrong, but the civilian prosecutor has decided for whatever reason that they are not going to proceed. I should also say that having the provision in the punitive article means we can do a non-judicial punishment. And there, you know, as we discussed, the system is very different, and we can go forward with non-judicial punishment even as the civilians go forward with their prosecution without any kind of concern about double jeopardy. So some things that we don't envision actually court-martialing people on, we might still want in the code so that we can use the non-judicial punishment provisions.
Thank you. Let me note that Representative Mellon has joined us, and Representative Tuck is online. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you. Captain, do you foresee or have your people discussed any other reasons that you might decide to pursue the case under the Alaska Code of Military Justice rather than through the state? For example, you might have easier access to certain witnesses, certain federal agencies, certain laboratories. It may be just easier for other reasons, too. Have you talked about that? Can you tell us?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, we have had some discussions along those lines, but I think our conclusion in most cases runs the other direction, which is we believe the civilian authorities have better access to resources. Certainly with regard to witnesses, I'm sure as you're familiar from your time in the military that, you know, service members can be compelled to appear and that kind of thing. But that usually is on the active duty side with Title 10. So the federal military has access to these resources. The federal military has the ability to fly people around the globe and do that kind of thing. It's not clear that we do in all cases. So in most cases where we contemplate us pursuing a charge where the civilians won't, it's either because it's a military charge the civilians cannot pursue, or as we've talked about here on the second point, the civilian authorities for some reason have affirmatively stated that they're not going to pursue. In most cases, we want, if there is something that's cognizable in both realms, we want civilians to prosecute the cases, not us.
May I follow up, please? How about you might have a situation where there's command pressure and there's for some reason militarily, either through the Guard itself in Alaska or even higher military authority, a desire
for some reason to pursue the case. Somebody might be deserting or something, and they're out for a long time, and somebody wants to make an example of them, which isn't, I mean, that's not a good example, because that's not a civilian crime. But for some reason, let's say for the purposes of our discussion today, a valid reason militarily, they'll want to pursue the case. And I'm not saying this is a problem. It may be some benefit, actually, to the system. But I'm suggesting that when you look at this from all corners, consider things that you haven't considered, because they're two different worlds.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, I think you're correct in that it's possible, although I would argue not likely. There are cases where we will want to take cases and we'll have to ask the civilian prosecutors not to. But we haven't had many of those kind of discussions. I'll say that, you know, while we definitely want to have very close relationships with the civilian authorities, again, we envision that the vast majority of crimes that can be prosecuted in civilian court will be prosecuted in civilian court. But you're absolutely right that there might be some situation where we want to go forward actively. And in those cases, because of this provision that we've clarified, it would be on us to work very closely with the civilian prosecutors, with the DA, to make sure that they affirmatively stated that they weren't going to pursue this case and they wanted us to do so.
Yeah, you're in a situation where, because of personalities involved, it could work either way, that you've got somebody on the civilian side who's a runner-gunner and wants the case, or vice versa. You're fortunate in the fact that these are two departments in the same state system, so I presume in that circumstance the governor would be the ultimate determiner. Is that your envision?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, yes. Ultimately, everything goes back to the governor, and the governor can make these kind of decisions to, in the military context, as you know, you talk about command pressure. Command pressure is forbidden by our laws and regulations. You cannot pressure a lower-level commander to prosecute someone. All you can do is reserve the case to yourself. You can draw that case up to yourself, and then you can prosecute it yourself. So the adjutant general could pursue a case that a lower-level commander didn't want to. But you cannot order a lower-level commander to prosecute someone. But you're right. But ultimately, all authority for both the DA and for the Department of Law and for the National Guard, ultimately it all goes back up to the governor. So we have one commander-in-chief.
You may, as you pursue this through the legislature, find some folks wanting clarification on that point, because from our side of the dais here, that's something that we want to be sure that everybody knows how potential disputes will be resolved, so we don't have another mess. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So if I could proceed to the next point.
Continue.
So, thank you, ma'am. So we had a discussion on September 22nd about the idea that what happens if a service member is in another state and is not on orders. And it was never sort of the intention of the Guard to pursue those people. If you misbehave in another state and you're not on orders, we didn't envision us pursuing you, and so we clarified that. So the way the statute is written now, if you are in the state of Alaska and you are a member of the National Guard, regardless if you are currently on active duty orders or not, you are subject to our jurisdiction. Also, if you travel outside the state and you are on active duty orders, if you are what we call TDY, or you're on a different kind of mission of some kind, we have jurisdiction over you. And so we clarified that. But if you misbehave in another state and you are just on vacation with your family or what have you, and you're not in uniform and you're not on orders, we are not going to try to pursue you. We're not going to try to prosecute you using this code. Presumably you'll be prosecuted if you misbehave under the criminal laws of that state.
Representative Greenberg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, of course, if you're going through South Dakota and you beat somebody up, then you'll be dealt with in that state. And I don't suppose it would arise that there would be any reason for there to be a question of jurisdiction with the South Dakota National Guard, because you'd be under one or the other. Let's say for the purpose, I guess I'm just kind of clarifying, suppose you're TDY, temporary duty, to the South Dakota National Guard, and you beat somebody up. Would there technically be jurisdiction under this new version in Alaska as well, or would it be ceded as a matter of law to South Dakota?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, assuming it was the kind of thing that we could pursue under our...
Yes.
We would have jurisdiction under this law to reach out using a long-arm provision and try to punish them militarily. Now, if South Dakota was pursuing criminal charges, I think we'd want to coordinate with the South Dakota authorities.
I'm talking, certainly, if it was, to interrupt, I'm sorry, if it was the civilian authorities, that
right.
case. But suppose it were not, suppose the person were TDY to the National Guard
right.
and went AWOL, and it was you and the South Dakota National Guard, how does the code resolve that issue?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, my understanding is that if it was AWOL, it would be our jurisdiction because they're absent without leave from our duty. But I do think you could think of it, for example, let's say they disrespected a superior officer in the South Dakota National Guard.
Right.
I don't have a good answer for you for that right now. I can try to get you that after the hearing. I don't know if we've had experience, if we've run into that yet, and I think it's a really interesting question. It might be that there is jurisdiction from both sides, and we'd have to resolve with the South Dakota Guard who would pursue them.
I'm not suggesting an answer. I'm suggesting if these are even theoretical issues, that we try to resolve them in the initial draft. And I don't know how other states do this so that, you know, we don't have two conflicting state codes, if we can.
Well, I guess I'm not sure we're kind of going down this trail. I think this is one of those conflict of laws thing, and it may very well be that both states or both National Guards have jurisdiction, and wherever they're tried first, we'll have to decide whose code to apply. But I even think that in civil law there may be cases in which both California and Alaska have jurisdiction, and it's not the statute that tells us which court has jurisdiction. That's something that the courts decide.
It depends, and if laws are well drafted, like in this area, we should try to resolve them in the drafting of the laws, and that's one value of uniform codes, because they resolve these kinds of things. I'm just leaving it. I'm not planning to go down. I just wanted to check if there's an issue here.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. May I proceed, ma'am?
Yes.
So additional changes. We've also made some changes to the title requested by Representative Grunberg. We clarified the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. We also created a three-strike system on recommendation of Representative Ledoux for the DUI provision, so it more closely mirrored the civilian law. There were some other issues with that I hope we're going to resolve in an amendment regarding whether someone was on orders or non-orders. It is the hope of the National Guard that we can sort of remove most of those distinctions, that whether you're on orders or non-orders is largely immaterial. If you are piloting a military vehicle of some kind, then there are other additional charges that you might be opening yourself up to. But the DUI provision itself, we envision that whether you're on orders or not is not particularly relevant at this stage, at least. But the important point is it creates a three-strike system where you have essentially you have a misdemeanor felony, that as you do in the civilian context, where you open yourself up to 1 year of potential jail time, 1 year of confinement, and then I believe it's the number of 5 years if for a third offense. I think someone getting to a third DUI without being discharged from the military is fairly unlikely in our current guard, but it's it's certainly possible, so we have that in there. We also create a system of alternates.
If somebody is a DUI, do you envision a circumstance where they'll be prosecuted under the military code?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, we put it in there on the eventuality that the civilian didn't pursue it, and then we would want to. Now, I'm aware that civilian, you know, the state of Alaska aggressively pursues DUIs, so I do believe it's relatively unlikely.
The reason I'm suggesting...
Through the chair.
The reason I'm suggesting this is I could see another reason why you may want to use this code. If, in fact, you prosecute for whatever crime under here, then presumably they would be remanded to some federal agency.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, no, that is not the case. The way the bill is written, the Alaska Department of Corrections will take custody of the individual if they receive confinement.
Would they have, if through the chair, if I may please, would they have any greater right to treatment? Because I can see if under federal law they would have a better right to, whether it's mental health treatment or whatever, people might aggressively want them to go through your system.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, we haven't done a comparison for the different treatments available. We have, as you are probably aware, we have an extensive substance abuse program, and we attempt to treat our soldiers and airmen. Whether they would lose rights to that under, if they were charged, I couldn't say. I believe what would happen is that they would be charged, they would go through the system, through the ASAP program, through the substance abuse program, and then they would probably be sentenced, they would actually go to trial, to the court-martial, and then be sentenced. That's an interesting question. It's an analysis we haven't done in detail.
Through the chair, I don't want to pursue...
If we continue on like this, especially since the meeting started almost a half hour late, we're never going to get through this.
Sorry, I'll just leave it at that, and I'd like an answer at some point.
Sir. Ma'am, we are coming up to the end here, fortunately. I guess I just wanted to also put things into perspective again and restate why the National Guard is doing this, why we are seeking out this bill, and why we've been so appreciative of the help that we've received from the legislature. This is your bill, ultimately, and you've been putting this forward and putting a lot of work into it over the summer, as we have dedicated a lot of resources to it as well. And you can see I have a fancy new stool that a graphic designer made for me. The goal ultimately is to promote good order and discipline in the force, to make sure that we are combat ready. As you've seen in the last week, things happen in the world, and we have to be ready to go. And we haven't been called upon yet, but we expect people who are in the National Guard now, perhaps unlike people who were in the National Guard several decades ago, expect to be deployed at some point in their service. We are a reserve component of the United States military, and we have to be combat ready. And to do that, we have to maintain good order and discipline in our force. And we have been lacking this fairly vital tool to promote good order and discipline until this point. And as I said at the beginning, we're very pleased with how far this bill has come. And it's on my next slide. We do feel that it was to pass as is. And certainly there's work to be done, and I'm sure that there will be work over the coming months to improve the bill. But were it to pass now, we believe it would create a functioning system of military justice in the state, which was always our ultimate goal, the thrust of this bill from the very beginning. And I think because of the hard work done by this committee and others during the course of this summer and this fall, we are at a point where that is the case. I'll touch on non-judicial punishment and the red team, which I've discussed before. The red team is meeting weekly now. We've been running through a number of scenarios. The preliminary results from that red team indicate that, again, that we have basically a functioning bill here, that the punitive articles do cover most of the misbehavior that we expect, and the nonjudicial punishment regulation, by and large, seems to work. One of the interesting results, actually, that we've seen in our scenarios is the commanders that we have running through these scenarios, they often don't use this tool. They still use the administrative tools that they have always been using. And what that indicates to us is, first of all, that the administrative tools will still be the primary mode of discipline in a lot of cases, things like letters of reprimand, reduction boards, separation boards, that kind of thing. But it also indicated to us that we have a long way to go, us being the Alaska National Guard. We have a long way to go to educate our own force and our commanders on how to use these tools, to demonstrate to them that these tools, in some cases, are more effective and can be used in a more timely fashion than the existing administrative tools. And so over the next few months, we're going to be putting together plans to help roll this out to the force. One last point on this, and it goes to point four. We in the red team and the command, the people that have been working on this bill, are now hearing from people in the force that they want these tools. I have people come up to me and say, when is it going to be ready? You know, a commander is saying, we want this. We would love to be able to use it right now. And what we've told them is, the earliest it could happen is the spring because of the legislative calendar. We hope this passes this spring, and then we will put forward the regulation and hope to have that signed shortly thereafter by the governor. And what we're telling our force now is the earliest we could expect these tools to be used after a period of education, after a period of us putting out material to the force on how to use them, would be the late summer. That is sort of when we expect these to actually go into force. Now, if you pass this bill in January, we could perhaps move that up a few months. But, of course, we're realistic with your time constraints. And so we're expecting to have this rolled out to the force over the summer, again, if we can hopefully pass this during the spring. So with that, if there are any other questions, I'm at your disposal. Happy to be here.
Representative Klayman.
Thank you. During the course of the summer, I believe there was a memo that you wrote discussing a number of questions that Rep. Cheryl Adu's office had, and one of the queries had to do with attempts and the question about how attempts were treated. And I apologize for not knowing the sections better, but I know that under Alaska law, attempt is generally scaled back one degree, and I don't think that was the case in the military code, and I'm wondering what's being done and what we have in front of us, and if you can direct me to the right section, that would be helpful.
Yes, sir. Representative Klayman through the chair. It's section 2605580 is attempts on page 36. So if you look at section B, so it's not formulaic in the way that some Alaska law is, where, you know, it was class A, so now it's class B or what have you. I forget which direction it goes. Is class A worse than class B, vice versa?
Through the chair, in Alaska, it goes down. So if it was a class A, then the attempt would be a class B.
Right.
If it was a class C, B felony, it would be class C felony.
Right.
If it was a class C felony, it would be a class A misdemeanor.
So, Representative Klayman through the chair, again, it's not formulaic in that way. And this language is taken from the state model code. But if you look at section B, section B, the second sentence, a court-martial may not direct a punishment for an attempt to commit an offense that is greater than the maximum punishment for the offense.
Okay.
So again, it doesn't have the same, doesn't automatically drop back in the same way, but we are clear that it cannot be more severe.
Okay. That answers it. Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. If I may have a little leeway, please. I don't practice criminal law as a family lawyer, as you may know. I'm looking at subsection C on page 36, since we're just talking about attempts. Is this subsection C currently in Title 11? Is that identical to state law? Do you know?
Representative Grunberg through the chair, I'm not familiar enough with Title 11 to give that answer. I will say that this language is from the state model code. So this is language provided by the National Guard Bureau. Not taken directly from Alaska state law.
Oh, because I thought that you were saying that it's identical to Alaska law. I don't.
I Representative Groom, with the chair, I don't believe so. I can double check on that.
I'd like you to, because this brings to mind a question. If in fact under sub C that you may be convicted of an attempt, even though the crime was consummated, the question to me is that a lesser included offense, and are you entitled to a jury instruction to that effect? You know,
Representative Groom, through the chair, I don't know at this time, but I can certainly research that for you.
Okay, thank you. And I want to go back now to what we were talking about.
Go ahead.
Let's look on page 3, section 2605-400.
Yes, sir.
And I'm looking at this from the point of view of a trial lawyer, something you just dropped. I don't know if that's okay. This is a very sophisticated... The law is a very sophisticated form of gamesmanship, and both sides do that, and that's the way they look at things. And here, there is a possibility of going forward in one of two forms. It looks like the prosecution is bound here, generally, to take the civil route, where the defense may not be similarly bound. Of course, it's a prosecution question. The defense doesn't really have the choice. But this isn't really so much a question as a comment here. You may want to talk to the defense bar, both military and civilian, to see how the interplay could be gained by either side. And you might find that their use of this provision or whatever provision is somewhat different than you have looked at, unless you've really had the folks who are going to be playing the game at the table telling you how it could be used.
So, Representative Groomberg, through the chair, I think you're correct in assuming that there will be some gamesmanship on both sides. I think it's a little bit difficult to predict how that will proceed at this point, because there are relatively few states that have this structure. That is, some states have only military offenses in their code, so this never comes into effect. And at the federal level, because it's a comprehensive criminal code, the federal military can always proceed. They can proceed without the civilians acceding to it. So I think you're, again, correct in assuming that we might run into some interesting scenarios in the future. They're a little bit hard to predict right now. I will say that we have been working with our own defense counsel on these provisions. So, you know, within the judge advocate's office, it's sort of interesting. People rotate back and forth between being prosecutors and being defense attorneys. In our office, in the last 6 months to a year, there's been a little bit more sort of calcifying, where some people have become basically prosecutors and the people have become basically defense attorneys almost exclusively. That's not typical in all judge advocates' offices. But we are, I believe, every one of our judge advocates has at least some defense experience. So we have been working with them with these kind of provisions. So I just want to assure, you know, it's not always the case, but I want to assure Representative Groomberg through the chair that defense counsel has not been excluded from this process.
No, I did through the chair. I didn't mean that they had been. I just kind of am flagging things because I have learned that any law will be used in ways, at least in my field, that couldn't possibly have been imagined. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Klayman?
Just going back briefly to the query that Representative Groomberg had about Section C of attempts having to do with if the evidence shows the crime was occurred. And I certainly will look forward to seeing the research, but my general sense on that particular provision is that it's there because oftentimes a crime will get charged under an attempt because the information they have at the time of charging is that it only rises to level of attempt. And then as the evidence comes forward, without having to recharge the individual, the evidence actually shows the crime was completed. But rather than having to go back through the whole cycle and recharge and reassess, they proceed under an attempt, probably at some level for reasons of judicial efficiency, but I think that's the reason why that's often included, because many times over the course of time from charging to trial, they learn more and circumstances change.
The victim hadn't died yet.
Right.
Any further questions? Well, I've actually got a couple myself. So let's turn to page 2, section 2. And I'm just looking at that first sentence, and I've not caught this before. But I'm wondering, on the third line, while in this such service, I'm not sure that makes any sense to me.
Representative.
Is that a typo, or is that?
Representative, I believe that's a typo.
It's been in all of the other ones also. So if you could just check and... page 8, section 2605-435. I'm not sure I understand that section.
Ma'am, was it 435?
Yes.
Okay. So, ma'am, there are two forces in the militia. There's the Army Guard and the Air Guard. So what it's saying essentially is the Army could charge the Air and the Air could charge the Army. It probably wouldn't happen in most cases, but you can imagine a situation where you have a mixed force and they are doing something in the field and something happens. And I think that is sort of what this is getting to.
Okay, so when it says the exercise of jurisdiction by one force over personnel of another force must be in accordance with the Code of Military Justice. Is that, you're talking about the Alaska Code of Military?
Yes, ma'am.
Justice?
Yes, ma'am. So if an Air Guard commander were for some reason to charge an Army Guard commander, or an Army Guard soldier, or vice versa, they would have to do so under these provisions, not under, the way I read it at least, not under maybe some other regulations they have, because there are some regulations that are unique to one force or the other. But if they're going to proceed with a court-martial or an MJP, they have to do it under this code.
Okay, thank you. Section 26... 05444, page 9.
Yes. Grand jury.
Section B. What's the difference between a district attorney or an attorney from the Department of Law? Aren't all of the people from the Department of Law assistant attorney generals?
Representative, Madam Chair, I believe that language was written by legislative legal. I'm not familiar with that structure. Perhaps she could speak to that question.
Okay. Is Megan Wallace on the phone right now?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Megan Wallace from Legal Services.
Thank you. So I was just asking a question on page 9, section 2605-444-B. So do we have actually somebody that are formally called district attorneys, or aren't people all assistant attorney generals?
I actually do not, I'm not sure. I'd have to look into that a little further. I believe the language was provided to us, but I can clarify that and get back to you if that's okay.
That would be just fine.
Madam Chair, I do think if you were to remove a district attorney and just have an attorney from the Department of Law, that would probably be sufficient.
I think that would probably do it. And I guess this bill has come so far that we're really getting down to the weeds here and noticing such things. Okay, page 15. Under investigation preliminary hearing. B2.
I'm sorry, ma'am, what did you say?
We're on 2605-468.
Uh-huh.
And we're on section C, C2, where it says the accused has the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses if the witnesses are available. And then it says a victim may not be required to testify at a preliminary hearing. A victim who declines to testify is considered unavailable for purposes of the preliminary hearing. How does that mirror regular criminal law?
Madam Chair, that is language taken from the most recent version of the federal UCMJ with regard to sex assault, the rape shield law, essentially. So the purpose of that provision is so that people aren't re-victimized on the stand or in preliminary hearings. So it's very much targeted at the victims of sexual assault. Now, as it's written, you can imagine some other victim, someone who was assaulted, for example, with a non-sexual assault, could also avail themselves of this provision. I don't know how it compares exactly to Alaska's rape shield law. I can only tell you that that language was taken from the more recent federal attempts at creating a rape shield law within the UCMJ.
Okay. Maybe I can ask Ms. Wallace that question. Ms. Wallace?
Yes, Madam Chair. Megan Wallace again. I don't normally draft in the criminal law section, and so I will have to look to see where our rape shield law is to give you a comparison to this provision.
Because I'm just having problems. Representative Clayman.
I'm fairly confident that what this provision is about, because it's coming from the national statute as opposed to a state. In many states, in felony prosecutions, the prosecution has an option of either presenting a case to the grand jury and hold somebody over to the felony trial, or they can proceed through a preliminary hearing. And if they go with a preliminary hearing process and then the court finds there's probable cause, then there's no need to go before the grand jury. And so, in contrast, in Alaska, you can have a preliminary hearing which would give the state the opportunity to hold somebody in custody, but it would not give that wouldn't hold them to answer for the charge. That would just allow them to hold them in custody until they could get the case before the grand jury, because there's no way to avoid the grand jury requirement for purposes of going to trial. People waive it all the time when they plead out, but cases that actually get presented to the grand, well, there's, to get to trial, they have to present it to the grand jury, and I believe this particular provision was designed to protect victims of crime from having to go through cross-examination two times, so that in the typical grand jury proceeding in this state, the victim would testify to the grand jury but would not be cross-examined by the defense counsel. In a preliminary hearing, say in California, the defense counsel would have an opportunity, essentially two bites at the apple with the victim the first time in the preliminary hearing if they proceeded with that, and the second time at the actual trial. And so this provision, as I read it, is an effort to try to protect victims of crime from having to go through two times testifying, and the provision about saying that they would be considered unavailable would make it so that the victim of crime who didn't want to testify couldn't be forced to appear by subpoena. At least that's my off-the-cuff analysis of what's going on here, and your research may suggest otherwise, but I'm pretty sure that's the dynamic that's at play.
So, Representative Clayman, through the chair, I think you might have a better knowledge of that process than I do, actually. but the federal, in the military, there's sort of a fairly well-established and I would even say aggressive system of investigation. And I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Senator Gillibrand from New York. Her and other leaders in the U.S. Senate and elsewhere sort of realized that the way the military investigated sex assaults was not sympathetic to the victims. And the investigation process was very aggressive and led to some very aggressive cross-examination. And for that purpose, I know they put in this amendment. Now, whether that, how that interplays with grand jury, I'm not sure. But I know that, practically speaking, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to prevent people from being re-victimized during the investigation process.
Well, through the chair, the one thing that I think is very clear in both federal level and state level is that in the grand jury, the defense attorney is outside the door. And we occasionally hear stories of defendants who choose to testify before the grand jury, but their lawyer doesn't get to go with them. And so that whole issue of cross-examination of victims is a non-issue in the grand jury proceeding.
Sir.
So how does this gel, this preliminary hearing gel with the grand jury that we've got in this bill?
It's, Madam Chair, it's a really interesting question. We, I believe, will be the only state that has a grand jury requirement, and we inserted that in there because it was the belief of my superiors that Alaska's uniquely strong protections, constitutional protections for a right to a grand jury. So other states haven't done this exactly. But I believe we're tending to satisfy due process. And either this preliminary hearing or the grand jury should satisfy. I don't believe we envision a case where you do both. It will be one or the other. And we haven't exactly war games yet when you'll go to either one. I believe that we'll probably skew towards this preliminary hearing process because it's more similar to established ways to do investigations in the military. But again,
well, wouldn't you have to if it's a felony, though?
Right.
Wouldn't you have to go to the grand jury?
So, Madam Chair, probably, I think is the answer.
And so, if you have to go before the grand jury, all of these sexual assault cases are felonies. So, again, I'm a little bit confused about.
Madam Chair, I guess one of the things to remember about sexual assaults is we expect that most of the investigation will be done by the civilians. And so this investigation process might not be as necessary on the military side in the case of sex assaults, for example, because we expect the vast majority of actual investigating will be done by trained civilians who know how to investigate sexual assaults. And then we'll present the evidence to the grand jury.
But you just told me that the reason for the Section B is so that we don't victimize the rape victim. And now you're telling me that you're not expecting to use this section for the rape. So, or the sexual assault. So it's just leaving me confused.
Yes, ma'am. We could probably, I could try to get you a more detailed answer and we could speak more offline. I think it is a confusing question. And like I said, we're the first state to do both at once, I believe. But even if we don't expect to use this process, in the unlikely cases that we do, we want to have protections in place for victims.
Understand that, but maybe it should be narrowed somewhat. I mean, if somebody is accusing somebody of beating them up and it's not a sexual assault and you don't need the rape shield law, why would that witness be shielded?
Well, so speaking, so we've taken out most of the regular assault, as you know, Madam Chair, but there is, so the example I would probably use more directly would be, I believe it's called abusive sexual contact. So we have we do have misdemeanor, essentially sexual crimes in the bill. So we wouldn't go to a grand jury, but we would have to do an investigation. And that person would have been victimized in a sexual way, even though it's only a misdemeanor. And we might want them to have these protections available to them.
All right, we can talk more about this, this provision.
Yep.
And I guess that...
Oh, I have a question on that.
Go ahead.
So can you explain what a misdemeanor sexual crime would be? I mean...
Representative Millett, through the chair, if you look at section... Let me see if I can find it. I believe it's 620. Mistaken here. Yeah.
Page 48 starts.
Yes. Actually, you know what? I misspoke. I believe our minimum punishment is 5 years, so it's still a felony. It's abuse of sexual contact. So the only misdemeanor crimes that are related to sex are 622, other sexual misconduct, and that has to do with things like indecent viewing and indecent exposure, that kind of thing. If there is physical contact with another person, a victim, it appears that we always have the ability to go up to 5 years of confinement, which we make it a felony.
So, let's look at page 16 then. And we're under the same section. And we're in section H, the definition of a victim, where it's talking about direct physical, emotional, or pecuniary harm.
Right.
So this sounds to me like it goes way, way beyond a victim of sexual assault.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. While certainly a lot of the motivation for putting these kind of protections in had to do with Rape Shield, and I was speaking with one of the leaders, one of the people at the JAG Center in Virginia about this provision, we spoke about it in terms of a Rape Shield law. The truth is it goes significantly beyond that. It protects victims sort of like as the Alaska law does as well. We have the Office of Victims' Rights, and we have provisions to protect victims, not just sex assault victims. So you're absolutely correct, Madam Chair. It's broader than just sex assault victims.
Right. We can talk some more about this. All right. Okay. 2605-485, the statute of limitations. And I think we have a memo about it's page 19. It's D. And when the United States is engaged at war or engaged in contingency operations, the running of the statute of limitations is extended, and we talked about that this actually means that it's extended probably forever. And this memo that I have from Dan Collins tries to explain the rationale behind that.
That's Colonel Collins. He is the staff judge advocate for Alaska National Guard.
But I guess I'm wondering, I mean, I understand that, let's say there is an operation in Iraq, and it's not a declared war, but it's just an operation, and somehow or other the National Guard is not federalized at this point. And so the operation in Iraq comes to an end. And so that would seem that that would be justification for extending the statute of limitations. But then we're in another contingency operation, let's say in Afghanistan. Well, why should it be continued for the operation in Afghanistan when it's come to light after the end of hostilities in Iraq, if you're following me?
Madam Chair, yes, I do follow you, and I think you could make an even stronger argument that, you know, if we're assuming that the National Guard service members are not serving in Iraq or Afghanistan, because if they were, of course, they would be fully federalized. They'd be Title 10. They'd be subject to the UCMJ. So in this scenario, they're being charged here in Alaska, they're not being charged, and the statute of limitations is being suspended because of some operation outside the state. And so the argument would have to be something along the lines of something about that contingency operation is taking resources out of the Guard and preventing us from proceeding with this in a timely fashion. I think it's an interesting policy question. It's something that yourself and Colonel Collins and the Guard should discuss whether we want to keep this in there or not, or have it revised in some way that it's clear that we aren't, the command of the National Guard is not trying to take advantage of this in some way, that we're not trying to keep someone in a state of basically suspended animation for
30 years.
Right. We've been in contingency operations in Afghanistan for 14 years. There hasn't been an official war declared, but so that being said, I think you can also imagine a case where there is a legitimate reason why we have this. You know, the Congress hasn't declared war, but we are engaged in something that looks very much like a war, for example, in Iraq or Afghanistan. So I think Colonel Collins's point in that memo, and the reason why we wanted to insert the word contingency operation, is because we didn't want to get caught up in the sort of legalese of what a war is. That is to say, like I said, we haven't technically been in a war since World War II, or perhaps Korea. I think it's World War II. As Representative Lin, you would know that better than I would. There was no declaration of war in Korea. Is that correct, sir? So it was just World War II. So we don't want to get caught up in that kind of legal debate. But I think we are open to discussions about limiting this in such a way that the National Guard can't abuse it.
Thank you. Maybe we'll chat with Colonel Collins then.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Goldberg?
When you have that, maybe that could be with the full committee.
Absolutely. Page 20, former Jeopardy, Section A. A person may not, without the person's consent, be tried a second time for the same offense under this chapter. So where would you have ever a person's consent to be tried?
What line are you in?
We're on page 20. Section 2605488, former Jeopardy, Section A.
Madam Chair, this is language taken from the state moral code directly, and I have to be honest, I can't really imagine a situation where it would be used, where someone would consent to that, but I could speak with the lawyers at National Guard Bureau and try to get back to you. Maybe they have a specific... scenario in mind.
Thank you.
I can't.
Go ahead, Representative Bloomberg.
There's a concept called manifest necessity. And the rule is that you cannot retry for the same crime unless the dismissal was for a manifest necessity, I think. It's been a long time since I've read it. But there are all kinds of doctrines. All I'm going to say is there are a lot of things in this that I don't remember.
Thank you. Maybe Colonel Collins can explain them.
We can get some research from Megan or somebody. The case, one of the main cases is a case called Lewis versus the State, or State versus Lewis. It's about 1968-69 case.
Section B. I'm not sure I understand Section B. I'm on the same
page. Are you lying?
I'm on 915 now. A proceeding in which an accused has been found guilty by a court-martial on any charge or specification is not a trial under the Code of Military Justice until a finding of guilty has become final after review of the case has been completed.
Madam Chair, again, I think this is something that I could speculate on, but I would rather try to get a better answer from you from National Guard Bureau and see exactly what they mean by that.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bloomberg.
Apparently, the phrase, quote, a trial under the Code of Military Justice is a term of art, that they're looking for the word trial to be defined by the UCMJ. It's not a civilian term, trial, and you're getting into a totally different land here. And I think this is important to put this stuff on the record because obviously we don't have experience in this area.
Well, maybe when we have our next hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, that, Madam Chair, that would be helpful because it's almost as though we need a dictionary. And the record's got to be very clear.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. Page 23. Section 2605-500, Section D, and that relates to if the accused remains incompetent for 5 years, the charges will be dismissed under this subsection. And so this is a question for Megan Wallace, I think. Is this the way this is done under our regular criminal laws? If somebody remains incompetent for 5 years, they get the charges dismissed?
Madam Chair, this is Megan Wallace again. I don't know off the top of my head, so I would have to do some research and pull the statute to see how our Title 12 proceedings handle that.
Thank you. If you could do that, and Captain Dunbar, why would you, assuming this is not the way things are done under Alaska law, why would you want to dismiss the charges, which could be quite serious charges, if 5 years have elapsed?
Madam Chair, again, this is language from the state model code, and I wouldn't want to speculate too much on what they were thinking about this. I suppose ultimately our maximum penalty is 10 years. If someone is committed for the purpose of trying to rehabilitate them for 5 years and could not become competent to stand trial, you could perhaps see a case where we didn't feel it was just to proceed with the charges. That's all I could think of. We don't criminally prosecute the mentally incapacitated. I think that's sort of what it boils down to.
Representative Gruenberg?
Generally, at least when I'm involved with legislation like this, if we're dealing with, let's say, taking a law from another state, or taking a uniform act, we try to get as a witness
the reporter for the commission that drafted the Uniform Act, or the sponsor or somebody who really knows the law, that law in Nebraska or something.
Right.
And it may, Madam Chair, be very helpful if a lot of this is taken from a model code, if we can have, maybe by telephone, at our next hearing, the people who are real experts in that. And not only is that helpful, Madam Chair, but I believe...
No, actually, I think that would be a good idea.
Representative Grunberg, to the Chair, I think that's a good idea. I do think it's going to be challenging, and the reason is because this was drafted in 2007, and in my own attempts to try to reach out to people in the National Guard Bureau, a lot of them are gone, basically. You know, the military has pretty high turnover in a lot of roles, and the people who were most intimately involved in drafting this model statute have dissipated to the wind.
I guess we talked about
this. We have several new judge advocates that might be able to speak to this that have experience in other states, and I do hope to perhaps get a hold of someone at National Guard Bureau that could answer some of these questions. I suspect that some of your inquiries will be unsatisfying, I'll put it that way. You're going to get a lot of people who say, we don't recall exactly why it was drafted this way.
Through the chair, the rule generally in this state, and I think the case is state versus bear, or bear versus B-E-A-R versus the state, is that if you take the law, a statute from another state, you take with it, and this is true with Uniform Acts too, you take with it the interpretation of the highest court, or it could be an intermediate court, a recorded court,
right,
that have been handed down before the effective date of our bill. So this is definitely an advantage, like with Uniform Act.
But Representative Grunberg, while there may have been things taken from the Uniform Code here, this is so far from a Uniform Code.
I'm saying that, Madam Chair, that if a particular section were taken from this model code, and I don't frankly know the answer, but whether other jurisdictions recorded, and I don't know how this works in the military. I mean, these are issues I don't know.
But Representative Grunberg, we're talking right now about the 5-year requirement, and we're just trying to find out whether this is something, why the military might want this. I don't think we need to get into, you know, what other states or et cetera at this point.
No, I'm just saying generally that may be, the reason I was saying this, Madam Chair, is because when, like with the Uniform Code, we look at the Uniform Code annotated, because that will contain...
Is there such a thing as a Uniform Code annotated for this?
No, not exactly. So, Madam Chair, so the state model code... I'm trying to think. The state model code does have some annotation on it. And then the federal UCMJ obviously has a lot of writing about it, a lot of precedent, a lot of that kind of thing. I think to get to what Representative Grunberg was saying, and perhaps it could help answer your question about this 5 years, is other states have adopted the model code, and some of them presumably have done some of these things. Their cases would not be controlling on us, because it would be a number of different states all trying to do this model code, but perhaps to be persuasive, right, to our courts. And we could look at other states and say, have you used this provision? Why did you use this provision in this way? I suspect that this particular provision has been rarely used. It might never have been used. And I would try to do some research and figure out if it has been used at any point. I suspect it hasn't.
Madam Chair, I wasn't limiting myself to this,
But this is what we're talking about right now, Representative Grunberg.
I'd like to come back to this at some point.
At some point. Okay. Page 41, section 2605-598. I guess I'm just looking at this, and this almost seems like in the civil courts when somebody has filed a frivolous cause of action just for delay, that they end up getting a fine by the court system. Representative Bloomberg?
Not that I'm aware of in the criminal sphere. Under Rule 82, in the civil cases, there's a subsection that allows enhanced attorney's fees. But I'm not aware of anything in the state law that allows you to enhance a fine because you raise a frivolous defense. We have somebody from the court system here who may be able to answer that, but I'm certainly not. Maybe we could ask her to come forward at some point.
She is going to be coming forward at some point. So, I mean, I'm just seeing this. I guess I'm seeing this as a fairly harsh punishment.
A year
in jail.
Madam Chair, if you look at the maximum punishment matrix that I provided, we have, so in our version for the unnecessary delay, the maximum punishment is 6 months and a bad conduct discharge. That's identical to the federal UCMJ. They have the same penalty. For the knowingly and intentionally fails to enforce or comply, we allow for up to 1 year and dishonorable. The federal UCMJ actually allows up to 5 years in dishonorable discharge. So while I agree that up to a year is a serious penalty, it's significantly less than what they would be subject to if they were on active duty.
So would this apply to defense attorneys, for example, who might be trying to delay things, because that's sometimes what defense attorneys do?
Representative, Madam Chair, I don't believe so, and I can certainly give you a more concrete answer, but I do not believe that is the case, because judge advocates that are defense counsel, just like defense attorneys in the civilian case, they attempt to, perhaps delay is the wrong word, but they try to extend the proceeding to the benefit of their client. That absolutely happens. I'll also say that, as we discussed earlier, judge advocates rotate back and forth at different times in their career between being a defense attorney and being a prosecutor. And so things are generally pretty collegial, and the kind of gamesmanship that you see in the civilian side, I think, happens a little bit less on the judge advocate within the military context. But the short answer is we don't prosecute defense attorneys for being defense attorneys.
Well, can you give, and then I'll go to you, Representative Bloomberg. So give me an example of where you're going to use this, on whom?
It's funny, Madam Chair, I had this conversation actually with someone who came out of active duty just a couple of weeks ago, and I'm trying to recall exactly what they said about this provision.
Racketeering cases.
If you don't mind, I would like to look it up in the manual for court-martial and get back to you after the proceeding.
Absolutely. Representative Bloomberg, did you have a question on this?
Yeah, I've got some comment. This can and is used sometimes in federal racketeering kinds of cases to force the defense lawyer to disgorge their fees. And that's how they get at them. And there's equivalent in under Rule 11, you have to certify stuff that did it. So, you know, do pleadings in good faith. But what they're talking could be, the only thing I'm thinking that might be something like this would be if an attorney disobeys a court order, they can be held in contempt of court. That's the remedy. This is going to have a significant chilling effect, particularly if the lawyer is a member of the military. You talked about command pressure.
I can't speak to federal racketeering charges. I will say, I believe what this actually deals with is cases where the where you can imagine a case of favoritism where a prosecuting judge advocate for reasons because they are sympathetic to the defendant in some way is intentionally and knowingly delaying the proceeding. I believe that was the example that was given to me. But again, I would like to have the opportunity to come back and give you a more concrete answer.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Page 42, 2605, 600, line 12.
42.
42.
12.
Oh.
What line?
Line 12.
Yes.
Where it says any other state of a place. I don't get that.
Wait a minute. I'm on page 42, line 12.
Any other state.
And then it says of a place. A member of the militia who compels or attempts to compel the commander of the militia of this state or of any other state of a place, a vessel, an aircraft.
So that's because it's a separate. So they're compelling a commander from this state or another state to surrender a place, vessel, aircraft, or other property.
To surrender.
So it's not written very well, so it's not clear. But it's a separate provision, I think. So you have the member of the militia is compelling the commander of our state or another state. Right, to give it up to an enemy or to abandon it in the face of a threat. So the subordinate is forcing the commander to give up a place, to give ground.
Okay, maybe you could work with, we could all work with legislative legal and get this drafted in a way that is more understandable.
Okay.
Madam Chair, and Bob, there's a term in the military where you surrender and you're under conditions where you're not supposed to surrender. And I forget the term of art there, but that's what they're talking about here. And it's not well drafted.
Right. So I think we could definitely put clarifying language in there. But I think the substance of the provision is good. It's just not written particularly well.
It's almost like unlawful surrendering.
Right. I don't know the term of art off the top of my head either.
Madam Chair, isn't there something in here that makes that a crime? Or is this it? Oh, this must be it, okay. Yeah. Because you and I talked about that, among other things, that were military crimes that are not civilian crimes.
Right.
May I ask one question?
Yes, go ahead.
Suppose this is, if the XO requires the CO to do something. It's a type of a mutiny is what it amounts to, in the Kmart.
Representative Greenberg, to the chair, mutiny has a very particular meaning in the military, but it is a provision here. We have mutiny. It's a really interesting question. When would be mutiny? When would be subordinate compelling surrender? We would look to the precedent of the UCMJ to determine that.
If I may, please. Why is this drafted? And it criminalizes only the subordinate. How about if the CO, gives up his command when he doesn't have to? I mean, there should be something in there that punishes the CO as well.
Representative Groomer, to the chair, I believe that could be. There's always a higher CO, right? Until you get up to the President of the United States.
I'm talking about the unit CO.
No, I know, but so Representative Groomer, to the chair, you would be disobeying some kind of order if you were wrongfully surrendering, or you would be engaging in mutiny, or you'd be deserting. There would be some kind of provision we could prosecute that, or it would be misbehavior in front of the enemy. There would be some kind of provision that we could prosecute that commander under. But you're correct that it wouldn't be this one.
I've got a question, one final thing. I'd like you to take a look and see why this is drafted only to get to subordinates. Should we amend it to include COs, commanding officers? And I don't need an answer now.
Okay.
Immediate CO. Well, we're talking about the unit commander.
Okay,
But not all the way up.
Well, in our case, I guess I misspoke. In our case, it would be the governor, not the president.
Right.
Page 44, 2605-610. What does hazarding mean?
So that's a again, it's a term of art, and there are specific a definition within the manual for court martial. The
page 44, section 2605-610.
The sort of general understanding is you are taking an unnecessary risk with this vehicle or ship, and you're putting it at risk of becoming damaged and usually losing the ship. I mean, the penalty, I believe, if you look at the penalty matrix, the maximum penalty under the federal law is death. And the reason is because the idea is that some commander that is commanding a battleship is unnecessarily running it up against a reef and is losing this thing that could lose us a battle or lose us, you know, potentially a conflict. So the penalty is death in the federal system. But we have amended this because we don't really have vessels. We actually do. We have several small, like Zodiacs, in my understanding, but we don't really have battleships or we don't have any aircraft carriers. We've amended this to make it apply to aircraft, which we have many, and vehicles, which we have many. So if you are taking a necessary risk, and in this case, willfully and wrongfully taking a risk in a way that will damage or destroy our vehicles, we are going to potentially prosecute you for that. And I'm sure you can imagine what those kind of risks would be. People, you know, joyriding in a tank, for example. And the penalty has been drastically reduced because we've amended it to include vehicles. We've dropped the penalty far below death.
So suppose they run a red light with a car. I mean,
so if the car was the property of the United States or of the militia, then yes, I believe they could be prosecuted under this. Now, practically speaking, would they be? Probably not. And they would have to be doing so willfully and wrongfully. They would have to be, it would be more than just them negligently running the red light. They would have to see the red light and say, I'm going to shoot through that red light, come hell or high water, and I'm going to do it in my military vehicle. And then we would potentially prosecute them for that.
You know, my problem with the answer, well, we're probably not going to do this, is that if you're probably not going to do it, you probably shouldn't have a law letting you do it, because then there's always the question of, well, why are you doing it to this person and you're not doing it to that person? So that concerns me just a little bit. It is right now, it is 3:29. I would like to continue this until we wrap up this, if everybody can stay. I'm thinking about a half hour or so. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. This is a very serious part of this code, and it is used in the Navy and various things, and I certainly do not think we should toss it out. If somebody's negligently driving their car or something, they're not going to be prosecuted under this. They'll be prosecuted for the traffic offense or whatever. But there is a problem with this, and that is there are only two degrees here. One is negligence and one is willful. There is not a provision for recklessness, and there ought to be. And I'd like you, please, to take a look at that. It may be that the genesis of this was from a jurisdiction that didn't have that intermediate phase, but we do in Alaska.
And Representative Kruger, through the chair, that might also resolve some of your concerns, Representative Ledoux, if we were to reduce the penalties in the negligent provision, and then, so right, negligence right now is a year, up to a year. Okay. If we were to reduce that to 6 months, and then have the reckless be a year, that might address some of your
that
concerns.
That actually would address some of them.
If I may respond. These are very serious things. You could have, when I was on the aircraft carrier, a guy landed, and instead of turning the plane, his fighter, to the right to get parked, the young man turned it to the left, and the aircraft was lost. Fortunately, he was not. But that would be negligent. It wouldn't be reckless. Be careful before you just eliminate something here, Captain.
I don't think we're talking about eliminating anything. We're talking about the idea that there will be willful, reckless, and negligent.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
All right. 2605-609. Property other than military property. Why is this even in here?
Representative, Madam Chair, again, this is taken from the state model code. I'd like to get you a more detailed answer. Because we have provisions for looting and that kind of thing, so presumably it's not talking about other civilians' property.
Madam Chair.
So it might be the property that we are in control of that is not military property, you know, some other civilian agency that we are asked to safeguard.
Maybe you could get back to us so that we actually know what it actually is supposed to.
Madam Chair, because then you don't get into an argument of whether the canned peas that they stole or whatever it was military or not. And, you know, so you have something here. I mean, that may well be the case.
I'm going to look it up.
Okay. 2605-611, and I guess my first question is for Ms. Wallace. So, under our regular criminal code, first-time offenders are subject to 1 year in imprisonment for DUI?
Madam Chair, this is Megan Wallace. You bear with me 1 second. I want to pull up the state offense. Madam Chair, I just need a minute to pull that up. If you want to pass, I can get back to you in a moment. I don't know it off the top of my head, and I don't want to give you misinformation.
Madam Chair, if we have a moment, I found the explanation of Article 109 in the federal UCMJ. We were just speaking of 609. So I misspoke. It's not for another agency. It's for another person. And so it's in situations where our soldiers or airmen, they're not stealing or looting property, but they are damaging or destroying the property of another person, and we want the authority to punish them for that. That's the explanation that's given here.
I think it's broader than that.
Wastes or spoils, as used in this article, refer to such wrongful acts of voluntary destruction of or permanent damage to real property as burning down buildings, burning piers, tearing down fences, or cutting down trees. The destruction is punishable whether done willfully, that is intentionally or recklessly, that is through a culpable disregard of the foreseeable consequences of some voluntary act. That's the definition in the manual for court-martial.
So I'm just trying to get a handle on why, I mean, I understand the reason for including sexual assault in here, even though that is not a military crime. But some of the other things that are included in here, for example, that, I mean, so why is that one provision picked out as something that the military wants to prosecute? I mean, as opposed to our entire penal code.
Right.
Which we don't have the entire penal code incorporated into here.
This was a military offense as in the state model code. This was not one of the offenses that we went through and said we wanted to add, like DUI and sexual assault. This came as a military offense from the state model code. I think you're correct that there are, for most of what I just described, for example, burning down someone else's house, there are obviously criminal law that could apply to that, state criminal law. But I do think there are cases where it would be a civil charge, not a criminal charge. So, for example,
yeah.
If you were, let's say that you were shoveling snow in Cordova, more realistically, as opposed to abroad. You're shoveling snow in Cordova, and one of your junior enlisted threw a shovel full of snow recklessly, not intentionally, and broke a window, or in some way significantly damaged someone else's property. That would not be a criminal charge, but we would be able to use this military offense to conduct a nonjudicial punishment or potentially a court-martial. So I do think this is distinct from, I don't think these kind of offenses are completely subsumed by existing Alaskan criminal law.
Well, actually, under your example, while it might not necessarily be prosecuted by the criminal authorities, I actually do think it would be a criminal offense if you recklessly throw a whole bunch of snow and it goes through somebody's window. I think that is a criminal offense. Whether the prosecutors choose to prosecute it
right.
or not, that's a totally different question.
That might be a bad example then, but I do think the examples do exist where you would not be criminally prosecuted.
Thank you. Ms. Wallace, do you have that?
Madam Chair, our current DUI provisions are governed by AS 2835030. Generally, a DUI is a Class A misdemeanor, and then the sentence is dependent upon various factors and exceptions. And so if you would repeat your question, I'll see if I can answer it. Otherwise, a lot of the sentencing comes into a case-by-case basis and the factors that are apparent, you know, with every incident prosecuted.
Okay. So I was asking you whether a first-time DUI was subject to a year in jail.
Correct. It's a Class A misdemeanor, so it's up to a year in jail, and it appears that it would be, but not less than 72 consecutive hours.
If there's
certain protections available.
So I noticed Ms. Mead there in the background. Maybe she would like to, from the court system, maybe she could enlighten us a little bit here.
Madam Chair, Megan Wallace, Legal Services. It may be helpful also to have Department of Law comment on prosecuting specific instances and crimes, because they're in charge of they prosecute these on a regular basis and have more specialized knowledge as it relates to these hypothetical situations.
Thank you. And the next time we have a hearing, I think we will invite the Department of Law here. Ms. Mead?
Hello. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and though the Department of Law, of course, would know better than I do just happen to know that for first-time DUI, the sentence is 3 days, 72 hours, as Ms. Wallace mentioned. That's standard. It could go above that for a B misdemeanor. The maximum is 90 days, but for first-time DUI, 72 hours is the standard punishment. For second time, 20 days in jail. And for third time, where it approaches felony, it's 120 days in jail.
So, but the maximum allowed for a first-time offender is what?
First-time DUI, I believe, is a Class B misdemeanor, Ms. Wallace said, and Class B misdemeanors have a 90-day max in jail. But again, the DUIs have a specified jail term in the statute, and those, I think, only theoretically could be exceeded. They are the 3 days in jail. So in my experience, a first-time DUI always gets 3 days in jail unless there's something extraordinary, like an extremely high blood alcohol content, in which case perhaps it could go to 5 days in jail. But it would be quite unheard of to have, 90 days or a year in jail for a first-time DUI.
Thank you. Okay, 2605-611. I actually think this section might need some working on. I mean, there is a real big difference between a careless or a reckless manner. I mean, and while under the influence. And I mean, generally, careless is negligent, which is just a violation. And I get it if somebody is, for example, driving a military vehicle. I don't have any problems with the military exerting a harsher sentence for a military vehicle, but this includes the person who is in the National Guard and who is totally off duty because we've decided to do it 24/7. So I've got some real problems with subjecting to somebody who may have just run a stop sign, which is normally just a violation, to a year in jail.
Madam Chair, you mean running a stop sign while intoxicated, correct?
Well, I'm not a member of the military. And careless or reckless?
While impaired by a substance.
There are two sections. A is just a careless or a reckless manner. And then one is just a careless or reckless manner. Or two is operate under the influence of alcohol.
This person is described by a substance described in AS 2605-14. And two is, I would imagine that a substance would be anything other than alcohol, under the influence of alcohol.
A member of the military, A, who operates or physically controls a non-military in a careless or reckless manner, or while impaired by a substance. So,
I see what you're saying. That or, right.
No, it's not.
It might not be, actually. So you're correct. This is a provision brought in from the federal UCMJ, and you're right that it probably does subject our soldiers, our airmen, to a higher standard than typical civilian. And
I don't have any problem with that.
Right.
While they're on duty.
Right.
But I have some real problems with that while they're not on duty.
Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
The term careless must have been taken from another jurisdiction.
Right.
Because we do not use that in Alaska. And that will be very confusing, and you might want to substitute negligence.
Representative Grunberg, to the chair, correct. This is taken from the federal UCMJ, so clearly it's a term that they use, and we can continue to work on that. In rereading this, I am curious if maybe that "or" was supposed to be an "and." It's materially important.
Well, because, Madam Chair, they use "or" in line 29 also. So it's disjunctive throughout.
So we're marking this, Representative Grunberg. I think we're all aware that there is perhaps a problem.
Yep.
Okay, 2605617. Provoking speeches or gestures. A member of the militia who uses provoking or reproachful words or gestures shall be punished by up to 6 months of confinement. So, does that mean if one militia person says to another, "You're an idiot"?
Or worse.
Or worse. But I mean, he can be jailed for up to 6 months? And can this happen while they're off duty, too?
It would be insubordination.
But that's not what it's talking about.
They should have been at my deck division. Every other word was a swear word. Can't have that. I mean, this is not a good word.
Hi, Madam Chair. So here's the definition, and I think it provides some of the limits that maybe will make you more comfortable with it. So, as used in this article, provoking and reproachful describe those words or gestures which are used in the presence of the person to whom they are directed and which a reasonable person would expect to induce a breach of the peace under the circumstances. So, fighting words, essentially. These words and gestures do not include reprimands, censures, reproofs, and the like, which are maybe properly administered in the interest of training efficiency or discipline in the armed forces. So, a reasonable person would have to expect that the provoking speeches or gestures would provoke a breach of the peace.
Representative Grunberg?
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to have very significant problems with this, having lived with guys on the deck division for 2 years. If you're talking about inciting a riot, then you ought to redraft this section. But this, as I'm sure that a friend on the right there knows, these people, every other word is a swear word.
So this is actually one of the few provisions, and I think this was an error on my part, but this is one of the few provisions where our punishments are potentially harsher than the UCMJ. They have the 6 months as we do. They have 6 months at the federal, we have 6 months. But they have no discharge where we have discharge. So perhaps we could reduce the potential punishments available to it. I would say that my command would be very upset if we took this out entirely, because this is a tool that I think is quite often used in the active duty context.
Madam Chair, may I respond? Take a look at a case called Anisket versus the state.
I'm sorry, can you spell that?
Aniskette. It's a 1971 case. It dealt with a policeman who was upset that somebody on the phone was swearing at him, and the guy was convicted of disturbing the peace or something or other, went up to the Supreme Court, and they reversed, and they said that, you know, this is something that you should have been able to deal with without...
You know, I understand where your command may be coming from. But I guess I have some real problems when we're talking about off-duty people. I mean, I just know how conversations amongst regular people can go, and sometimes they get pretty mad.
Yes, ma'am. Another important limiting factor here is this is only towards another member of the militia. So
I mean, that would be like a rule. One legislator can only say nasty things against another member of the if they're off duty.
So in this case, they would have to be off duty, but speaking to each other face to face. It couldn't be over the phone. It couldn't be. I mean, that's how it's defined. The definition I read. You have to be physically face to face, and a reasonable person has to be able to conclude that it would provoke them to a breach of the peace.
But that's not yes. I'm sorry, Representative Lynn. Oh. Representative Lynn first, and then Representative Miller.
Well, I almost forgot my point, but the thing is,
there are many colorful words which many of us have used from time to time, but it's one thing to use this language as a matter of expression, another thing to get in somebody's face and use the same language. You know, I might stub my toe and say damn or something worse, but another thing to get in somebody's face and use one of these words that we all know of. And no, I'm not going to suggest that we list all the words in this document, but I mean, it goes to the fighting words kind of thing, I think, because we say these things just off the cuff sometimes, and maybe in a joking manner. But if you get into my face and do it, it's a whole different thing, and we all know that.
Understand. Representative Miller.
So my question would be, that leaves a lot for interpretation, provoking. What provokes you might not provoke me. So you're leaving a lot of interpretation and judgment call in that position, especially if it's in a situation where you're off-duty and you've got a superior talking to someone who's under them, and what's the likelihood of that being thought of as, well, you're provoking me because you outrank me, or flip it either way. So what I'm saying is it leaves a lot of room for, it's subjective at best.
Representative Millett, through the chair, I think it's intended to be a reasonable person standard that is, in theory, objective, but we'll take into account what you just described. You take into account the age of the person, the rank of the person, that kind of thing. Are these words likely to provoke that particular person? Taken in a, theoretically objective standard. And we would, if I was the defense attorney and I was defending you against this charge, I would go to the federal case law, I would go to the case law that this is based on and say, here are examples where it doesn't fit. And conversely, if I was the prosecutor, I would do the same. I would say, this is the kind of words that have been prosecuted successfully in the past. So I guess my point is that we would be drawing upon and looking to case law to try to determine what actually is. It wouldn't be just anybody's opinion as to what it does or does not constitute fighting words. I agree that by the fact that we are prosecuting people off duty means that it is larger than some other states have contemplated. But again, I do think that if we want to have the ability to non-judicially punish people under this provision, and I think we do, and I think my command wants this in here pretty strongly, so that if we have an affray, if we have a verbal altercation between two off-duty soldiers, or airmen, but probably soldiers, we want to have the ability to discipline them, and this is an important tool to have us do so.
Is that a follow-up, Representative Miller? And
I guess I am uncomfortable with it because you don't know my personal history, I don't know your personal history, you don't know what's going to set me off or provoke me. And so, subject to case law, that's fine, but you don't know my personal history. We've become so politically correct in our society these days. You don't know me, I don't know you, and I would assume that not every officer knows every other officer, or every enlisted knows every other enlisted's history. So what provokes you, what provokes me, and what the case law has might not even cover what the verbal altercation was about. I guess that's my concern. It's just really, I don't think case law can take into every conversation or every provocative conversation I may have.
Yes, ma'am, and I think to go to your point, in the explanation provided from in the UCMJ, the Manual for Court Martial, it says, it is not necessary that the accused have knowledge of the person toward whom the words or gestures are directed as a person subject to the code. So you don't even have to know the other person is a service member for this to apply. So to go to your point, you're right. We will prosecute you regardless of whether you knew that that person had some specific thing that was going to set them off. So you're right. It is a broad power. There's no question. But to kind of get to kind of pull back a little bit on this, and we do hold our soldiers and airmen into a higher standard than civilians are expected to. Maybe it is the case of civilians. It's okay for civilians to get up in each other's face and scream and cuss, typically. But when we swear to uphold the Constitution of the state and follow every regulation and every order that's handed down, we are expected to give up certain things, and perhaps the ability to swear in someone's face is one of those. That being said, I am sympathetic to the notion that perhaps 6 months in prison is a long time.
Because, you know, the guard is, and this military code, is the guard in its role as a governmental entity, as a military, but it's also the guard in its role as an employer. So as an employer, heck, if I don't want my employees to be swearing, I might be able to kick them out of my place of employ.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing. But I can't make them go to jail because I don't like what they're doing. And so that's where I've got my problems.
Yes, ma'am.
With the jail element of this.
Yes, ma'am. I think, so let's envision, let's play this out a little bit. Let's say we take out the ability to put them in prison here, and then we also take out the ability to discharge them. We would still be able to use nonjudicial punishment to reduce them in rank and to fine them. So you still would be able to punish them. Again, we've had this discussion before. I think Representative Tuck brought this up about the idea that we're an employer. We see ourselves, the Guard sees ourselves as much more than just an employer, as you know. You are committing yourself to an organization that has the power of life and death over you. So it goes beyond a typical employee-employer relationship. But I'm sympathetic to the notion that putting someone in jail for 6 months might be severe.
And we've done this with a couple of the other sections where things are a little bit too broad. So did you have something, Representative?
Yeah,
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, of course, the National Guard is on duty 24/7, where they're actually, in uniform on the base on duty. So they are on duty 24/7. I want to make sure we separate this from insubordination. Can there be insubordination when you're not on duty out in the civilian realm? If you know the person you're directing these words at is a superior officer. Now, sometimes you would know, sometimes you would not, but there needs to be a clear distinction between insubordination. You have insubordination on duty on the base or someplace, and you be at a party someplace in civilian clothing and still be insubordinate to a superior officer or to your commander, and he may be in civilian clothing, but you know who he is. Okay? I'm thinking this is more or less these kind of words or gestures directed towards somebody of the same or similar rank that you would know of. Obviously, you don't know whether somebody walking down the street is in the guard or not. So but we need to have some good variety of this is needed. And I agree with most of what the captain is saying here.
Representative Lynn, through the chair, you're correct that there is a different kind of offense when you are addressing a superior officer. And actually, to get back to the chair's point, We already took out the ability to impose a sentence of confinement in disrespect towards superior officer, although we left in the ability to dishonorably discharge. It's section, it's 589 on page 39. At the request of the chair, we inserted section B. So it actually is, I think you've kind of hit upon an interesting contradiction here, where we, as it stands now, you could disrespect a superior officer and we couldn't confine you, but if you disrespected another enlisted, we could, which is, as you know, backwards. So perhaps that is a contradiction that you have identified in this version. Representative Lynn, you're absolutely correct that there are different insubordination, provoking gestures, and disrespect towards superior officers are distinct provisions, and we do have provisions for each.
Thank you.
Representative Bloomberg?
This, I think, since we're running out of time, is going to need to be talked about with us individually by you at some length, particularly since we have all these others over here on page 39. Do we really need this when most of the conduct that we're really concerned about probably is or ought to be in that part of the bill? And I'll just leave it at that. And if you might tell your superiors, at least, not your superior, well, the chain of command there, at least my feeling anyway, I think everybody's here. If you're going to keep this in, which I think you ought to be very careful before you do keep it in, but if you do, it shouldn't be starting from the broad language. It should be starting from the narrowest possible language and justifying going beyond that. But you're not going to cover every single thing, but we are a state legislature by a constitution that protects individual rights, and this is way beyond anything that would even provide a threat. This is something that's not even threatening. And unless I'm convinced we really need this, I'm not going to support this particular provision, unfortunately.
Okay, I think we all know that some of us, many of us, have some problems with this. It is 410 or 405, and if Representative Grunberg needs to go, then we will lose our quorum. And so we are actually almost finished with this, but I think we're going to resume our discussion.
I didn't get to my comments at all, so we'll have to do this. No, I don't want to do this today.
In January.
Did you want a motion to put this in?
Not at this point. So with that, we are adjourned. It is 4:05.
One final thing.